Funding for Smart Talk is provided by Capital Blue Cross. For 80 years, Capital Blue Cross has offered products that provide peace of mind and promote good health, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Health and Wellness Centers that provide in-person service and inspire healthy living. Capital Blue Cross is behind you for whatever lies ahead. More information is at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross. Live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, who is studying a new surgical technique that allows surgeons to make repairs to the heart without having to open the chest cavity and while the heart is beating. Info at upmcpinnacle.com.
Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The Tax Cuts and Job Act of 2017 is now law, and the new code is now in effect for the 2018 tax year. There are a multitude of changes, the elimination of many deductions, the contraction of brackets, the doubling of the standard deduction. It would take several weeks on Smart Talk to go over all 479 pages of the law, but we're going to look at a few aspects of it today. There has been concern within the home building and real estate industries that the new laws could de-incentivize new and existing home purchases. Some of these concerns were addressed in the final amendments to the bill. Joining us in the studio to parse out some of the details and answer some of those questions are Todd Umbenhauer, who is president of the Pennsylvania Realtors Association. Mr. Umbenhauer, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having us.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Maybe you're thinking about buying a home, selling a home, or maybe you're just wondering about what this means to your existing home and what you're looking to do in the future. 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call. All right, I'm going to start off with the broad question. So what do realtors, what do those whose job is to sell, buy homes, think of this new tax bill?
Well, Scott, the concern that we have is the federal government for 100 years has provided significant tax advantages for purchasing real estate. And those incentives have been greatly reduced by the new tax legislation that has been passed.
Why do you say they were greatly reduced? In what way?
Well, in the past, you had a number of write-offs. Real estate property taxes, state and local income taxes. While some of those remain, they have been curtailed. For example, you have a $10,000 maximum for deductions for real estate taxes as well as state and local income taxes. Well, there are many parts of the Commonwealth where just the real estate taxes alone exceed $10,000. So you won't even get to state and local income taxes as part of your deduction. So what used to be an unlimited deduction for those categories is now limited to $10,000. From the standpoint of mortgage interest, those deductions remain in place, but there are some limits there. It used to be limits for higher-end properties of up to $1 million for mortgages. That interest would be deductible. That has now been reduced to $750,000. So for the upscale properties, the mortgage interest is still there as a deduction, but has been reduced.
Mm-hmm. You use the word upscale. There are some people listening to this who would say, well, you know, what many Americans have been clamoring for over the years is that those who are well-to-do, those who have higher incomes, be taxed at a higher rate or that they pay more, you know, I think the term that's been used, a bigger share of the taxes. So are we talking about just people who have upscale homes who will be impacted by this, or does this go to the middle class? Just your, you know, someone maybe buying their first home?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Scott. Certainly, when you get into categories of $750,000 mortgages, $1 million mortgages, those are upscale properties. But I will hasten to add on the issue of real estate taxes and state and local income taxes, you are not going into the ultra expensive properties in many areas to reach property tax levels that will take you past that $10,000 property. In the area in which I live, in Montgomery County, many of the properties are owned by two income families, and they are able to purchase a $400,000, $450,000 home. And in many cases, those homes are near or above $10,000 in property taxes. So this is not the ultra rich that we're talking about here. This is middle America that is being impacted by decreasing the incentives for achieving the American dream of home ownership.
I want to go back to that, but when you talk about achieving the American dream of home ownership, this is a big economic driver in this country too. I mean, what impact do you see this having then on, building, the economy overall?
Yeah. Well, to be sure, the economic events that occur around the sale and the purchase of a home, all you have to do is watch your neighbor when they sell their home. They've got contractors lining up on the months before they get their house on the market, painters, carpenters, people who are in the trades. Likewise, when someone purchases a home, they do the same thing. They bring in floor covering specialists, things of that nature. So there is an awful lot of economic activity that occurs over the sale of just one home in the community. So if something happens to take some of the pace out of the market, that's going to be felt by the local independent contractors, the tradespeople who make their living oftentimes as a result of a property being sold in their area.
Speaking of the pace of home sales right now, let's kind of bring this home where we are right now, going into 2018. I know that there are certain areas of this region in particular that home sales have been, booming. So overall in Pennsylvania, what have we seen over the last year or so?
Well, all real estate is local, of course, Scott.
Right.
But in looking at statistics that have been provided by the Greater Harrisburg Association of Realtors, Suburban West, which is Southeast Pennsylvania, Greater Lehigh Valley, the trends are very clear. The median sale prices have been increasing in Greater Harrisburg. They increased over the past year by 6.8%. And the days on market, and that's a very telling factor, they have been steadily decreasing year after year, down to 56 is the average days on market in the Greater Harrisburg area. That's a 21% reduction in days on market from the year past. And those results are consistent in East Pennsylvania, Greater Lehigh Valley. Prices have been tending up. Days on market have been tending down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a good barometer just for everyone who doesn't know, because think back to 2008, 2009, 2010, how long you heard horror stories of people who were trying to sell their homes that were on the market for 6 months, maybe even longer.
Absolutely.
So the shorter the period of time shows that, there's a real boom in selling houses. Prices going up, though. Supply and demand?
Without question, as the prices go up and as the days on market decrease, it's a sign of a lack of inventory. And as I travel across the state, what I'm told by my contemporaries is the biggest problem we have is lack of inventory. So when you have a lack of inventory or low inventory, there's going to be more competition for the few homes that are for sale, which, of course, will drive the prices up. It's a supply and demand situation. I'm pleased that the appreciation that we've seen has not been double digit, because then things tend to get a little out of control and you run into real estate bubbles. But at a pace of 4%, 5%, 6%, that's a manageable increase in values that will not cause the effects that we saw, as you referenced, in 2007, 2008.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so with all that said, and going back to your very first answer to my first question about you're concerned that this will be a disincentive for home buyers, let's face it, a lot of times, and this is almost a cliche, that perception is reality. Are you concerned that there are people who this will say, you know what, we're just going to hold off and wait and see what happens.
I think certainly there will be some people who will take that position. Right now, Scott, I really believe it's a little too new. I don't think people have gotten their hands around, even tax professionals are not all on the same page as to all of the ramifications of that nearly 500-page piece of legislation. I did ask, I may have mentioned my daughter and son-in-law purchased their first home in Satterton a year and a half ago, and I specifically asked them, had this act passed prior to you purchasing a home, would you have gone through with that purchase? The answer was yes. We were living in an apartment. We wanted to get into a home, but we are very disappointed that some of the tax incentives attendant to home ownership have been greatly diminished. And even to the point, I didn't prompt them on this, but even to the point where they may take that into consideration during the next election cycle.
So I want to get back to the, you know, $10,000, you know, the top of the line $10,000, the cutoff. I have to admit that a lot of the media coverage, the national media, when they've talked about that issue, they focused on high tax states. Like we keep hearing about New Jersey, California, Texas.
New York, yeah.
New York, states that it's common to have real estate taxes over that $10,000 limit. I saw a gentleman from New Jersey on NBC who said that you know, his tax bill was $25,000, and this was probably going to drive him out of his home. Pennsylvania was kind of identified as a low tax state. So it may surprise some people to hear there are homeowners across the state who are paying more than $10,000.
That's an interesting comment. I wish that I would be able to say with all enthusiasm that Pennsylvania is a low tax state.
Yeah. When you're paying them, it doesn't feel that way, does it?
No. So I would say certainly there are areas in the Commonwealth where very, very few people would be paying real estate taxes in excess of $10,000. But there certainly are, Scott, areas in our state, you know, southeast Pennsylvania, even here in the Harrisburg area, where it's you don't have to get into that high of a price property where you are threatening that $10,000 threshold. And remember, real estate taxes are only a part of that $10,000 bucket filling. There's state and local real estate income taxes as well. So that bucket can be filled and overflowing for many Pennsylvanians pretty quickly.
And I think that something that many people may not realize, of course, I know there are a lot who do, but that when you get in different regions of the state, home prices change. I mean, you mentioned southeastern Pennsylvania. Often felt that you cross that line between Lancaster County into Chester County into the Philadelphia Delaware Valley, that you're going to pay more for a home. Now, there are people who will say, well, you know, you probably will have a higher income, have a higher paying job. But the reality is that the homes do cost more in the Delaware Valley, southeastern Pennsylvania. Is that the area of the state that will be hit particularly hard with this?
That is one of the areas of the state that will be hit particularly hard. But I think you would find people in the Harrisburg area, I think you would find that there will be people who are realizing, wow, we're going to be going over that $10,000 threshold. We've gone over it before, and we're no longer going to be able to have as much in the way of deductions as we have had over the last 10 years that we've owned this home.
We're going to talk more about the tax reform bill and just a couple aspects of it coming up in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
Smart Talk is supported by Capital Blue Cross, providing health care coverage accepted by doctors and specialists in all 50 states. More information is available at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, who has offered transapical mitral valve repair procedures for more than 3 years and currently serves as a trial site for over 50 clinical trials. Information at upmcpinnacle.com/myheart.
Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about a couple of different aspects of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 that took effect January 1st of 2018. During this portion of the program, we've been looking at real estate, looking at home sales, maybe even home building. But I want to bring in to the tax collectors here in just a moment. By the way, if you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Our guest is Todd Umbenhauer, president of the Pennsylvania Realtors Association. I want to bring in a second guest now, and she is with the Pennsylvania Tax Collectors Association. Sherry Labs, president of the Pennsylvania State Tax Collectors Association. And Ms. Labs, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Good
morning.
Thanks for having me.
All right, from a tax collector's point of view, what we've heard over the past week or so is so many people across the country who were trying to prepay their real estate taxes, their property taxes, before January 1st, hoping that they could get the tax rate of 2017 rather than 2018. Here in Pennsylvania, we learned that that is not legal, correct?
That's correct, right.
Pennsylvania
statute prohibits that.
So in Pennsylvania, I mean, I read stories or heard stories about a number of your members across the state who were being contacted by many, many taxpayers out there. Tell me a little bit about it.
Oh, my word. It was collectors were being inundated with telephone calls from individuals seeking to, prepay an estimated amount for their 2018 taxes. But in Pennsylvania, the tax collectors are prohibited from collecting on taxes for a succeeding year before their current tax year has been settled out. And the process in Pennsylvania works that we settle by January 15th of the following year. So that is essentially what stopped us from being able to even consider accepting those payments.
Well, it's pretty much history now anyway, but a question I did want to ask is, do taxpayers have any options, ways that they maybe can save some taxes now, save on their taxes here on in 2018?
To save on their income taxes or real estate taxes?
Real estate taxes.
Yeah, at this point, no. In terms of paying on the tax, some areas have not even been assessed yet, and that's really primarily the majority of the state. So the collectors would not even have the dollar figures or the listing of the valuations at this point.
Well, that was my question, because this happened so fast that, I mean, just from speaking with Mr. Umbenhauer, that, about how there are so many people out there that don't know quite what's going on or how they'll be impacted by this. But
right.
You're in a situation, counties are in a situation where they haven't even gotten their bills out yet, and you talked about assessments. What's going on in a typical year? What is going on right now?
In terms of the process for assessments and billing?
Yes.
Right now, collectors in Pennsylvania are settling out there. We call it, the terminology is duplicate, for the 2017 tax year. And so what that essentially means is all unpaid taxes are turned over primarily to the tax claim bureaus, the county tax claim bureaus. So we, as tax collectors, are compiling that information and creating the reports and closing out all of that paperwork to turn over to them so that everything balances to zero. Once we complete that process, then the counties will provide us with the new listing for the 2018 tax year.
You mentioned income tax, and I think that most people, when they think of tax collectors across Pennsylvania, think of property taxes, real estate taxes to begin with. But what about income taxes?
Income taxes are not collected by the real estate tax collectors in Pennsylvania.
Right, yeah. But I just wondered whether there were any in some municipalities where, there were local taxes being collected. So tax collectors have nothing to do with income taxes being collected?
They don't.
Okay.
They don't.
So what advice would you give property owners as far as preparing or learning about this new tax law when it comes to paying their real estate taxes?
Well, really, I think the best thing that we can do right now is educate ourselves on what exactly this does mean. I did listen to your previous segment with Todd, and he was good in explaining it, and I think that that's part of the problem. There's so much misinformation out here. What exactly does it mean for us? What exactly are the limitations in real estate taxes as combined with that $10,000 cap? And so I think that's the first thing that we can do at this point to help ourselves moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Hey, thank you very much. This is Sherry Lapp. She's the president of the Pennsylvania State Tax Collectors Association. Ms. Lapp, thank you for being with us today.
Oh, thank you.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Let's go to John in Lancaster County. John, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Scott.
Morning.
Great conversation here. I just want to point out the fact that this past year, my wife and I were looking into selling our current home and buying a new home. And the home that we currently live in, we paid roughly $165,000 for it. And as many people know, in Lancaster County, they've done some reassessments, and we have yet to get our new tax bill to see what the new rate will be. But I'd like to point out that we looked into bigger homes. The one home in particular was being sold or was on the market for about roughly $280,000. And the taxes on that property were somewhere in the range of $7,000. And that was a lot of home, for that money. So my opinion is, and some people may see this as inflammatory or just outrageous, but if you're paying $10,000 or more in property taxes, obviously you've got some money in the bank, and I don't see that this is really going to affect you as much as you really think it's going to.
Mm-hmm. Hey, well, thank you very.
And that's all I have to say. I'll take my response off.
All right.
The air.
Hey, John, thank you very much for your call. And Todd, I kind of want to get back to you that this is something that we touched on a little bit earlier, but there may be a lot of people thinking that way.
Well, and I think the caller identifies something that addresses another yet to be seen scenario, in that people who own properties who have those tax bills of $7,000, $10,000, $15,000 per year, they're wondering, when it's their turn to sell, what impact will the new tax legislation have on the value of their home? Because if the purchasers, and many times purchasers are moving up, they've been used to the write-offs that they've had on property taxes and mortgage interest, it may well impact what they are willing to pay for that next move-up home. If they're not going to have the same tax benefits that they've had before, it's going to impact what they're willing to pay. So the legislation could cause some downward pressure on the prices that people can sell their homes for that have those higher real estate tax bills.
Reassessment. He mentioned reassessment. Lancaster County is one of a number of counties going through reassessments that occur every few years. For a lot of people, maybe not as often as what they like, or maybe too often for what they like. But what I hear when I hear reassessment and the questions that listeners have is there's a lot of unknown with this. And with the unknown, people tend to get cautious.
Well, if you're speaking about the reassessment process, and there are areas in the state where there has not been a countywide reassessment for 30 years, mm-hmm. 40 years or more, that's a problem. Our view is that you have to have more current information to be properly assessing and taxing the people within your jurisdiction. So we would like to see much more frequent reassessments in order to have a balancing, a more fair tax structure in each county.
Well, that brings up the whole issue, and I didn't mean to get off on a tangent here, but these things are all interrelated. Property taxes. Here on the state level, we've been talking about the federal tax bill, but here on the state level, there has been a move in the last few years, and maybe again this year, to eliminate property taxes, go to more of an income tax, higher sales taxes in some area. What do realtors think about that? What does your association think about that?
Well, certainly the Pennsylvania Association of Realtors supports property tax reform. We in the past supported Senate Bill 76, which I know that you have covered on,
yes,
on your,
often,
your,
yeah,
your programming here. We continue to support property tax reform. We are reviewing any pending legislation that would address property tax reform. So we believe that there's a better way to fund public education rather than on the backs of the property owners, homeowners across the Commonwealth.
Well, what kind of property tax reform would you support?
Well, right now we really can't speak to something that does not exist. In the past, the state was looking at the expansion of sales tax and the increase of personal income taxes. We were in support of that measure at that time. What will happen in the future, we have to analyze that as something is presented in the legislature.
Well, you say that you can't really address something that's not there, but there are only a few options. I mean, do you have one that you
Well, we supported the expansion of sales tax and the increase of personal income tax as a way of taking the burden of public education off of property owners.
In your business, your industry, your members have to be very interested in school funding. Because let's face it, for families especially, that is a major part of where a family decides to buy a home is the quality of the schools.
Absolutely.
Correct?
Yes.
So how important is that to you?
Oh, obviously the quality of education in the community is paramount. And we believed in the legislation that we supported in the past that public education would not suffer. It would be an even exchange from property taxes to the expansion of the other personal taxes we've mentioned. Mm.
We only have a minute or so left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. Just kind of leave a message with our listeners. What would realtors, what would the home buying, home selling, home building industry like to see come out of this tax reform bill?
Well, what I'll say is the only the ability to have tax deductions is not the only reason why someone purchases a home. Obviously, there may be some additional amendments to this legislation. We would like to see some more progress in regaining some of those tax incentives that have been given up in this new legislation. But buying a home is still a great investment. People don't buy properties just for the tax deductions, but that certainly is a very important part of the equation.
Todd Umenhauer is president of the Pennsylvania Realtors Association. Mr. Umenhauer, thank you very much for being with us today.
Scott, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. One of the nation's worst prison uprisings occurred at New York State's Attica Prison in September 1971. 39 men, including 8 hostages, were killed when state police and corrections officers stormed the prison after a 4-day standoff. There are aspects of what happened at Attica that resonate today. So why did it take 45 years to write the story? Heather Ann Thompson is author of the book Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. Heather Ann Thompson, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. All right, so I'll ask that question right up front. Why did it take 45 years to write this book?
Well, this was a very important prison protest that I think for your listeners that just heard talk from Mr. Wetzel about what conditions are like in prison, they'll quickly understand. Things were bad as well in 1971. It was a moment when there was a lot of protest. In this case, though, the state of New York shut down the protest very violently, And thereafter really have tried to protect the records to make sure that nobody understood the full scope of how bad the retaking was. And so the book took a really long time to write, in part because the records have been shut down. They've been barred from view. And so part of the book writing was trying to just figure out the story, you know, where those records were and how to get the story.
But you actually did get access to records that many people haven't seen, correct?
Well, that is true, and indeed quite by accident. The book took 13 years to write and probably couldn't have been written at all had it not been for the survivors who are still so determined to tell their stories, both the hostage survivors and the prisoner survivors. But to really get at the story, to really get at the full scope of what I argue was nothing short of a cover-up, and I don't use that word lightly, that required me actually stumbling across some state records that were in a courthouse that undoubtedly nobody knew were there. They have since disappeared, but they did let me see sort of how state officials worked really hard to protect the police, to make sure that what they had done on that day of the retaking was never going to see the light of day of a courtroom.
Well, we want to talk about that because it is truly, I mean, it's incredible, the story that you do tell about that, about the retaking of the prison. But let's go back to 1971, before September 1971. What were conditions like at Attica?
Well, you know, much like today, prisons are these places that are completely shut away from society. And so most citizens don't know what goes on behind bars. But in 71, what was going on was pretty egregious. The men inside were being fed on less than 63 cents a day. They were routinely denied medical care to the point where, you know, injuries would turn into chronic injuries would turn into something fatal. People lost their teeth because there was no dental care, which, again, sounds a bit like a luxury till you realize you need your teeth to eat. There were lots of incidents of racial abuse. And all of this went on in a context where people inside were trying to ask for help. They were writing letters, trying to go through the system. And when none of that really worked, eventually they just explode in frustration. And that leads to what, you know, what I try to suggest is a really extraordinary human rights protest within the prison.
Let's go back to early September 1971. The uprising itself, kind of, we had Secretary Wetzel talking about a fight as kind of innocuous because it happens every day in a prison. But what started this uprising was really kind of something that does happen every day in a prison. But what happened that it rose to this great protest?
Well, I think that, again, just like today, people misunderstand what will lead people to that kind of explosion. And often what it is just simply not being heard for days and months and weeks on end. In the case of the Attica men, by the way, many of whom, this is a maximum security facility, but some of them were in there, very, very young guys, parole violators. And it was only after they had just completely lost patience with being ignored that one relatively minor incident, which is that prison management yet again tried to clamp down on the guys, just kind of explodes. And it, what really starts off as just an explosion of violence, very quickly and actually quite accidentally, a gate opens accidentally, becomes an extraordinary protest where the guys come together in one yard, they elect representatives to speak for them, they invite the media in because they understand how important it is to do this in public so that the world can see what's really happening, and they begin to ask for these basic human rights from the state. They bring in observers to help them negotiate, and for 4 days, the world watches as these prisoners try to bring basic human rights into the prison.
But they did take hostages, right?
They did, and they did it first in a very quite violent fashion. There was complete chaos. The prisoners were terrified. The guards were terrified, and some of the prisoners grabbed hostages in the belief that the state would be much more willing to negotiate if they felt that they had to protect their own employees. And indeed, for 4 days, I think that did work. That they had some modicum of protection from an all-out assault from the state, because they did have these guard hostages who, incidentally, come to really support many of the prisoner demands. They actually tell the state, please work with these guys. They actually have some legitimate concerns. But ultimately, what the retaking of the prison shows is that the state did not value its own employees at all. I have evidence in my book that they knew they were going to kill their own when they went in, and they did it anyway.
Mm. And we'll talk about that in just a moment, but I want to talk a little bit about these negotiations. The prisoners had a couple dozen demands. They made a list of over 30. And the state, during negotiations, actually agreed to about 28 of these. So you would think that, the majority, the great majority, were agreed to by the state, that would be enough to end it. But it wasn't, was it?
No, and actually really digging into that a bit more in the book, we discover that there's a couple of things going on. Yes, on the surface, many of those demands were agreed to, and these, again, are things like, improving the sanitary conditions of the men, allowing them to shower more, things that basic, but also larger things like improving the parole system or ending slave labor inside the prison. But the men were very savvy, and they understood that the wording and a lot of that agreement was meant to be vague. In other words, that these were things that could be rolled back immediately. But most importantly, the state refused to agree to the one thing that, incidentally, everyone, the hostages, the prisoners, and the observers knew was critical, and that was that they got amnesty for having rebelled. That if they surrendered, if they gave the hostages back, if they surrendered, that they would not be charged with crimes or physically assaulted. And that's where the state refused to budge. And it was on that point that negotiations began to break down.
Now, this all went all the way to the governor's office. Nelson Rockefeller was the Republican governor of New York at the time. Of course, Nelson Rockefeller went on to become the vice president of the United States. One of the demands was that they wanted Rockefeller to actually show up at Attica. He never did. Why was that important to the prisoners?
Well, it's interesting. That wasn't one of the official demands, but it was certainly something that the observers, and again, who the observers were is important. These were including Republican state senators, key journalists like Tom Wicker of the New York Times. They all wanted Rockefeller to come because if he wasn't going to agree to amnesty, they felt that if he at least came, stood outside of the prison, and endorsed the proposals that the state had agreed to, agreed that he would not retaliate should the prisoners surrender, that at least him being there would somehow give some gravitas to the state's word, right? That it would somehow persuade the prisoners that the state would not harm them if they surrendered. That's what he refused to do. And we now know that in part that was because he had already decided he was going to take the prison with violence. And indeed, you mentioned he became the vice president. Well, that in part is why he later on will work so hard to make sure that what happened on that day of the retaking remained secret.
Mm. Rockefeller maintained that the uprising was caused by black militants. There was a big racial component to this because many of the prisoners, the majority of them, were African-American. So I just lay that out for some background purposes. 4 days after the uprising, the decision was made to storm the prison and take it back. I say the decision was made. It was probably made before that, as you said.
Exactly.
But to storm the prison, take it back came 4 days later. Now, who were involved in the takeover? And one of the things that really stands out in the book is this was not very well planned.
No. So while these negotiations are going on inside of the prison for 4 days and four nights, meanwhile, outside of the prison, every state troop barrack had sent their state troopers to Attica. They had been milling around for 4 days. angry, really being fed on this diet of rumor that prisoners were doing terrible things on the inside. Rumors, incidentally, we know now, coming from the FBI. And these guys were passing out weapons indiscriminately. They weren't writing down serial numbers. They were itching to get inside. That's who the governor sent in on the fifth morning of the uprising. And what ensued was nothing short of a bloodbath. These men took off their identifying badges before they went in, and they went on a shooting spree. And when it all was said and done, there were many dead prisoners and hostages. 128 men had been shot very, very severely. And then the troopers began to torture the prisoners, and that went on for weeks and months.
Well, when I talked about it not being very well planned, one of the first things that they did when they decided to retake the prison was to bring tear gas in. And so, you know, from at the very least, even if they wanted to decide, you know, when someone someone's life was in danger and maybe that it was justified a shooting, they couldn't see. So they went in and, as you said, indiscriminately shot people, hostages and prisoners alike, without being able to see who they were even shooting.
Well, I think what's interesting is that, you know, people might assume that the book is anti-law enforcement or anti-guard and only pro-prisoner when you hear a story like this. But in fact, the book tries to do a good job of reminding us that the troopers were put in an untenable situation as well. That, in other words, that these decisions were being made at the highest levels of government. Nixon was the president. He had one question, and that is this a black business? And if it was, it was perfectly okay that there were so many fatalities inside. So the troopers are sent in untrained, many of whom were traumatized by the trauma that they caused and saw. The prisoners suffered extraordinarily. So did the guard hostages. But at the end of the day, the head of the state police, the governor's office, the presidency, the FBI, all of the people with the real power came out of this completely unscathed.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Our guest during this portion of the program is Heather Ann Thompson, author of the book Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or you can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Also, go to WITF's Facebook page. Let's take a call from Gary in Juniata County. Gary, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much, and thank you for trying to bring out, you know, part of history that probably is just, you know, let go. I think the people that try this, I remember going through the MOVE crisis. I worked at University of Pennsylvania in research. I was there that day. Now, that was several blocks away, but you could see the fire, you could see all the things, and the stories that were coming out were so one-sided. And it took so long to get the truth to come out. And that was something that was right in our backyard. It happened right under everybody's eyes. And the way the newscasters were reporting it, whatever, it was, you know, all the MOVE people's fault. And it just, it's hard for people to get the truth to come out, but it finally comes out. I'm just hoping that the revisionist people don't hurry up then. And, you know, once it gets printed, then, you know, it slightly changes over time. And, you know, that's the problem with a lot of this. It finally comes out, but then how many generations from now will it be told the same way? Thank you very much.
Gary, thank you very much for your call. Heather, what about that? I mean,
I love the caller's reference to the MOVE crisis in Philadelphia because I think that there are such similarities. This is, you know, as the caller said, you know, what the public thinks happens in these moments when there's a conflict between law enforcement and the citizenry is so determined by the way these events are reported at the time. And the reason why at Attica, everyone just assumed that the prisoners had killed the hostages, not law enforcement, that prisoners are the worst of the worst, and therefore, you know, we should embark upon a 40-year project of mass incarceration. All of that came originally from the fact that the media spun the story that way. The New York Times, the LA Times, were told that the prisoners had killed the hostages, and without any corroboration, that's what they printed. And so, you know, like with the MOVE crisis, what did Philadelphia's residents read? They read what the reporters were reporting, and what they were reporting was coming from the police themselves. So that's why it is important that we dig into the records independently of both journalists and the state authorities who are putting out the stories.
One point you just made about the hostages being killed by the prisoners, and I do want to get into the investigations, but one of the most striking parts of the story is that a coroner in New York State, in one of the counties, who did the autopsies on the hostages, you know, came out and said they all were killed by gunfire, and that you know, there were none of the prisoners who had access to firearms, so that they were killed by those who took over the prison. But that's not the story that came out.
Right. And that's, again, where we have to be so careful when we hear these news stories today about shootings, to really probe, to really ask questions. In this case, everybody that was killed on the 13th of September 1971 was shot by law enforcement bullets. But somehow, the world was told that the prisoners had slit the throats of the hostages, that they had tortured them, that they had, in fact, castrated one of the guards. And that story not only goes out on the AP and every newspaper in America, but when a hapless coroner who, you know, is determined to tell the truth by going public and saying, no, everybody was shot with law enforcement bullets, he is hounded and harassed. The governor tries to discredit him by saying that he's a communist, interestingly, even though he personally was a Goldwater supporter. And when that didn't work, you know, when they couldn't fully discredit him, they brought in two other coroners. And when they confirmed the first coroner's version of events, they then said that something different had happened still, which is that, well, if anyone had been shot, it was simply in the crossfire. So it really, who dominates the narrative very much determines how history is understood for generations, as your caller points out.
As you said earlier, there was a major cover-up. Who orchestrated this cover-up?
Well, I think it's not one person. I think it was just this concerted effort on the part of the state police, the head of the state police, who knew that atrocities had gone on the 13th of September. It was up to the governor, who knew he had ordered that retaking, and all of the minions in between. They all understood that they had to stand together. And so the book reveals that they had a series of meetings at Rockefeller's very lush estate in upstate New York, where all of these people, including the attorney general who was supposed to be investigating what had happened at Attica, the state police who had, you know, orchestrated the assault, and the governor's office who had called for it, met over several weekends. They got their story straight about what happened. The state police allowed demanded that one of the more particularly violent troopers left his job. They altered statements. They altered film. They altered photographs. They, you know, buried evidence behind the prison. And out of all of that, I think, was born just a really decades-long attempt to make sure no one knew the full scope of the story.
And we only have about 3 minutes left, and I can't go into all the investigations because there were numerous investigations, and the state fought those investigators all along the way. Charges were very slow to come against any of the troopers or the corrections officers. But it seemed that the civil cases, that's when things kind of turned around. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that the one thing that I want to leave, make sure people realize by the end of the story, is that while it is true that this is an extraordinary effort on the part of people with power to make sure the story isn't told, the people who are really at the center of the story are the prisoners and the hostages, who are determined that the truth will come out and that some modicum of justice will be served. And so at the end of the day, they both take on the state. And even though the state never admits responsibility, at least they do have the opportunity to put their stories on the record and get some modicum of financial recompense at the end.
You know, one of the things that if people just looked at the story and they wonder about the credibility sometimes or how effective the criminal justice system is, not just the criminal justice system, but justice system overall, is how long it took some of these cases to make their way through the courts. I mean, there were cases well into the 1990s and 2000s where that hadn't been decided.
That's right. And so what we come away with in the book, I hope, is a sense that we need to both insist on equal justice under the law. You know, whether someone wears a badge or someone wears a prison uniform, everybody should have the same treatment under the law. And that we also need to, you know, to take care to remind ourselves that the people behind bars are human beings, and that if they are not treated as such, they will eventually demand to be heard, and we need to really make sure that our prisons reflect our values, not places that we're ashamed of and places that we need to hide.
We only have about 45 seconds left, and you just kind of partially answered this question, but why is this story relevant today?
Well, because today we now lock up more people than any other country on the globe, and the conditions in prisons are worse today than they were in 1971. And while we have some good-hearted people on the inside trying to make it better, the folks on the outside need to first demand that prisons are treating people better. And we won't do that if we don't understand what goes on behind those bars, and I hope this story helps to do that.
Heather Ann Thompson is author of the book Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. Ms. Thompson, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we discuss the role of civics in education and how our schools help to cultivate good citizens, not just civic education, but overall how Americans really are lacking when it comes to civic education, knowing about the history of the government, knowing about the history of the country, I should say, and how our government works. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. It includes former First Lady Marjorie Rendell will be with us. And that's coming up on tomorrow's show, so be sure to tune in.
Smart Talk is produced by WITF as part of our mission to deliver relevant, high-quality programming. Support comes from Capital Blue Cross, which shares WITF's commitment to being a trusted resource in our communities. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle. Its 11 principal investigators and 12 nurse coordinators conduct research efforts to advance cardiovascular medicine. Information at upmcpinnacle.com/myheart.